Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith.
It's not like Port-au-Prince is this dangerous place where everyone's going to get assaulted. People were surprised to see us walking on the streets, but they were very friendly, and we talked to many people.
EMT and action medic Roger Benham returned from volunteering in Haiti on February 2nd. He joins us for a two-part special on relief efforts there. The U.S. military arrived in Haiti expecting violence, and as a result, aid was held up at the airport while security measures were sorted out. Roger Benham is part of a different kind of group, Mutual Aid Disaster Relief, online at mutualaiddisasterrelief.org. They arrived in Haiti a week after the quake, anticipating the need and expecting to simply do their best to meet it. We hear about their inspirational success at working hand in hand with Haitians. First, another inspirational update from Sunseer Ali Shakur, a musician and part of the ad hoc U.S. group, being able to move heaven and earth for Haiti, or BAM. When we last spoke with Sunseer, he was fundraising and coordinating media and aid for Haitian earthquake victims through 11 groups, including Mutual Aid Disaster Relief. Sunseer Shakur's life has just taken a remarkable turn. The lives of 19 young Haitian orphans will be part of his life and Haiti's future. For now, we might call them the Shakur 19. Sunseer Shakur, just tell us about this amazing development.
2 weeks ago, BAM, which is short for Being Able to Move, Heaven and Earth for Haiti, a Haitian relief organization that I started here in North Carolina, had gotten a telephone call from Juliette Bouquet. And she said that she had 19 children, ranging from the age of 1 week old to 6 years old, that didn't have any names, that didn't have any parents. And she wanted me to assist her in building an orphanage for these children. And she assured me that she already had property, which we already got checked out. It's like 2 acres of land. So I've taken advantage of the resources that I've had, and Pacific Domes out of Ashland, Oregon, will be sending me 3 shelter domes. One will be 60 feet, and the other two will be like 20 feet. And I have people coming down from the former people from Waveland, the Rainbow folks. They're coming down to help me. His name is Flower. He's coming down to help me build an outdoor kitchen and put together an outdoor shower and bathroom for the kids. And I have an organization out of Dallas, Texas, that's also going to be going down with me to do a garden and some art projects for the children. Presently, I got the UN to send beans and rice, UNICEF to send beans and rice, water, and milk. I'm presently trying to organize a medical team out of Patientville to go to the children and start a medical profile on them. And since they didn't have any names, I sent Ms. Juliette 23 names. And all of them have my last name because I want to adopt all these children. I'm making a 20-year commitment to the children to do for them what any parent would do for any one child. That's housing, food, proper education, health care, and an active lifestyle, and a physically active lifestyle.
What about needs like translation? Are the kids able to, you know, articulate their needs to you as well?
No, I haven't met the children yet. They're still in Haiti. Like I said, they're only like from 1 week to 6 years old, so they're not able to articulate to me directly what their needs are or anything like that. The first time I will meet the kids will be March 13th when I go over with a crew of, let's say, 60 people and supplies on a 747 on the back of Mr. Paul Pumphrey out of Washington, D.C., who's taking us all over to help erect a school in Port-au-Prince. After we finish with the school, we're going down to put together this orphanage for these children.
Tell us more about the medical team that may be able to help these kids.
The medical team that I'm referring to is, hopefully it will be Fletcher Allen Hospital out of Vermont. I've been in contact with these guys, and they are going to be in country for the next 6 months. And they have, since Mutual Aid Disaster Relief, the larger national group that I'm with, has successfully sent 4 different medical teams in about 6 different areas in Haiti. Fletcher Allen is relying on my logistics to point them in the right direction where to plug into.
And what about things like, you know, clothing and health checkups, you know, as far as that goes on an ongoing basis? You're looking at a very big responsibility here. Are you going to now live in Haiti?
I am very much thinking about moving to Haiti. I have a commitment this summer where I work with children with extreme emotional problems in New Hampshire. And I am seriously thinking about just packing up everything and being with them every day to act as a beacon so that continuous food, clothing, you know, education, health care can come in. There's enough resources at my fingertips now to keep that going for maybe about a year. But beyond that, for the next 19 years, I'm definitely going to need people, kind people with good hearts, to assist me with these children. I definitely can't do it by myself, but I will try. I definitely will try.
And are you hoping to bring Haitians into this, you know, as far as running this place and working with these kids?
Well, BAM, the local relief organization that I started here, is 98% Haitian. The sister that I'm working with the orphanage, she's also Haitian as well. Miss Juliette is Haitian. And she's a nurse here in New York, and she went over to Haiti 3 days after the earthquake and found these children. And she's asking for my help. BAM basically is a vehicle for Haitian Americans and Haitians to help one another, and we're just acting as a support unit.
And tell us how we can locate you on the internet or get in touch with you.
Right now, because Sincere has his fingers in about 32 different things right now, I still have basically a whole medical team left in Haiti. You guys can call me at 828-776-0062. We are still trying to put BAM's website up, and that should be within the next couple of days. Also, too, you can go to mutualaiddisasterrelief.org and pull that site up and look at the amazing work that this group has done within 6 weeks. A lot of people don't realize we've been in country since week one, and we've been able to send four medical teams there and send about 3,000 pounds of medical supply. And now Mutual Aid is focusing on long-term relief through BAM's efforts. We have a civil engineer department with BAM that's Haitian. These brothers are they're going to Boston University. And they're working on a rehabilitation center for amputees. There is, of course, the BAM orphanage that I'm working with Ms. Julia. And there is an educational component that we're sponsoring Phuket out of Jacmel. He has a group of children that he's working with in the countryside there. And out of this same pool of children, Mr. Phuket has formed a Haitian Boy Scout troop. So BAM is also going to be sponsoring that as well. And BAM is also affiliated with a black psychologist group out of Washington, D.C. As soon as I get off this phone call, I need to call them and try to start getting those guys over there to help out.
And finally, about this orphanage, can you give us more information about where the location will be?
The location is 36 miles outside of Port-au-Prince. I believe the area is called Louisville 17. If anyone needs any more information about the orphanage or how they can plug in, like I said, you can give me a call. I field 98% of my phone calls, and ongoing information will be posted by this weekend on BAM's website.
Sincere Shakur,
yes,
thank you so much for giving us this update, and good luck to you.
Dory, thank you for being there for me. I'm not going to be able to raise these children by myself, but I'm committed to them, and I'm going to need as much help as possible from the community. And thank you so very much for helping me out once again.
Many days we wait in the rain and sun, waiting for that bus that never comes. You pass by in your fancy car.
Reggae artist Humble with Concrete Castle King, and that about Haiti. Roger Benham of Windham County, Connecticut, went to Haiti with Mutual Aid Disaster Relief, mutualaiddisasterrelief.org. Roger, just begin by explaining what the group does.
Well, this is a group that came together in the early days after the earthquake that hit Port-au-Prince, and it came together initially around one specific individual, Thomas Easley, who is an herbalist from Alabama, and he'd been working at an orphanage in Port-au-Prince for the last couple of years with his program called Herbs for Orphans. He became acquainted with a friend of mine, Grace Keller, who is a community health worker in New Orleans, and through her, I heard that he was interested in going to Port-au-Prince, and he wanted to initially check on the orphanage where he had been working, but also to do some direct care after the earthquake. So Grace and I are both action medics, and so we know people in a loose network of people around the country who usually came together to do first aid and direct care at large demonstrations and mobilizations. But after Hurricane Katrina in 2005, I and a couple other action medics went to New Orleans and started something called the Common Ground Health Clinic, which is still a functioning health clinic in New Orleans. And so based on that experience, the network has grown to include a lot of other people that are more involved in doing ongoing care. And considering that we had experience, a bunch of us had experience going to New Orleans right after Katrina, Grace proposed to Thomas the idea that she would try to recruit some people to go with him on this missionary flight out of Florida, which he had gotten seats on 1 week after the quake. So initially, Thomas with five others went to Port-au-Prince. They had clearance to fly into Port-au-Prince. They reached there 1 week after the quake, and they were staying at a Christian missionary compound in the Cazo neighborhood, which is just north of Saint Louverture Airport in Port-au-Prince. And that group was Thomas, who was an herbalist, and then several street medics who were trained as wilderness emergency medical technicians, and one individual, Chris Gaucher from New York City, who grew up in Haiti and spoke fluent English and Creole. And he's a EMTB in New York City. And they ended up, on the flight down, they connected with an emergency room doctor who was going to Haiti and his two sons, who were both also wilderness EMTs. And so when they reached Port-au-Prince, they just went out and started to do direct care. They went out to 10 cities where people had not had access to much in the way of medical attention. And kind of under the medical direction of this ER doctor, they started to treat some very severe wounds and doing things like changing bandages, transporting people to hospital facilities in Port-au-Prince if they needed further care. And they were going into these tent cities and many times in places where other medical teams weren't allowed to go because they didn't have security. So they were doing this without security and just dependent on Chris, who, like I said, is Haitian and knows fluent Creole, and on his abilities to communicate with people. And that's why the first week they were there, they saw quite a few patients. They estimate they probably saw 700 patients. There were eight of them at any one time, including the doctor and his two sons. And they transported a number of other patients. And they ended up establishing a relationship with the University of Miami Hospital, which is located at the airport in Port-au-Prince. And through them, we were able to obtain supplies, and then they would bring them patients as well. But by the time that I got there about 5 days after they did, and I flew in with a team of several other people, one of whom was a paramedic, and then the other people were just organizers and a few action medics, but people who didn't have a larger, more advanced medical training. And we initially conceived of going in to help out the first team and joining them and perhaps giving them some additional support, but it took us a while to get into Haiti. We couldn't fly directly into Port-au-Prince. We got a free flight into Santiago in the Dominican Republic, and we're supposed to have transportation from there into Port-au-Prince, but our transportation had fallen through, so we had to make a detour through Santo Domingo and take the bus into Port-au-Prince. Our team was traveling with a man by the name of Claude Hillel, who just by chance met Chris Gaucher in a store in New York City, a backpacking store, just before Chris left for Haiti, and that's how he found out about our network. Claude's family's from Port-au-Prince. He grew up in Haiti. He's also fluent in French and Creole, and he's a physical therapist in New York, and he was very eager to get to Port-au-Prince because there were a bunch of his relatives who were there. They had gathered for a family celebration just before the earthquake, and several of them were killed, so he was anxious to reach his surviving family members, and that's where we stayed the first 3 nights we were there with his family in the Bon Repos neighborhood, which is just north of the main part of Port-au-Prince. Claude eventually ended up getting a position on the USNS Comfort, which is the U.S. Navy hospital ship that's in Port-au-Prince, and he's still there. He'll be there till the end of the month, rehabilitating post-operative patients, amputees mainly. A lot of the work that we ended up doing there was not a lot of direct trauma care, because by the time we arrived, the need for that had pretty much been met as far as people out in the tent city went. I did do several days of direct care going out with mobile clinics, but a lot more of what we were seeing was the transition from immediate post-earthquake injuries, although there still were a lot of people who had those injuries and were dealing with them. A lot of amputees, you know, and you have to continue to change bandages, and there is work that you need to do after you've had an amputation in order to ensure that it heals properly. But a lot of things that we were seeing were the chronic conditions that exist in Haiti anyway as a result of poverty and lack of access to good nutrition and clean water. So when in the mobile clinics, it was a lot of children with preventable diseases and a lot of dehydration as a result of diarrhea connected with these diseases that we don't really see in the United States anymore because of vaccinations, diseases like measles and mumps and diphtheria and things like that.
I noticed on the website for Mutual Aid Disaster Relief, there is a report now that the World Health Organization's new policy is that Haitians pay for medical care, amputees possibly leaving without being able to afford crutches. So what do you know about these kinds of developments? Because I know the media has been more emphasizing this huge security role being played by U.S. forces in Haiti.
That's a very recent development. I think they made that decision in the last 2 days to shift from a disaster response to a public health perspective. And so they are looking for payment. Most of that payment is expected to come from non-governmental organizations, not from Haitian patients themselves. I think you're referring to a report from the fourth team that our network has sent down, who are in Haiti now, and they are working at a hospital in Saint-Marc, which is a city a considerable distance north of Port-au-Prince, but a lot of refugees from the city have ended up in these other smaller cities scattered around the island. And that's a team made up mainly of EMTs and one registered nurse, but they are assisting at that hospital, and they're doing everything from taking care of people in post-op situations to assisting in surgeries, which is kind of a common development that happens a lot in Haiti. Having talked to friends of mine that have been to Haiti before the earthquake, this is something that often happens, is Westerners with a little bit of education or even language skills are pressed into service to aid in medical procedures that they would never be able to do in the United States under the direction of Haitian or oftentimes American or European doctors. But that pay-as-you-go thing, it's intended to make sure that there's accountability in the dispersal of supplies. In the immediate aftermath of the disaster, that wasn't as much of a concern because you're not as concerned with accountability for every little bit of lidocaine or bandages when you're making interventions that can have an effect on saving somebody's life within a time frame of a couple of days. But over the long haul, you know, in disaster response, organizations have gotten into trouble because of their lack of accountability. Just think about what happened with the American Red Cross after Katrina. They collected a lot of money that was supposed to go to Katrina relief, and I think it was after Katrina. Maybe I'm mixing that up with 9/11, but they ended up getting so much money that they just put some of it into their regular operations. And they got into a bit of trouble with that because you don't want to be misrepresenting what you're raising funds for. But I think the fact that they're in Saint-Marc and not in Port-au-Prince may be one of the reasons why they're having trouble accessing those supplies. They're also, my understanding is that they're a Haitian hospital, and oftentimes it's difficult for Haitian medical personnel to access United Nations supplies. That probably goes back to legitimate concerns about corruption and theft, but it's way overplayed. Going to Haiti, my experience anyway, is if you're Haitian, you are treated very differently than if you're American or European. And a lot of Haitian people themselves have internalized this. This is my experience anyway. And would defer to Blancs, as they're called in Haiti. A Blanc is, you know, the French term for white, but if you're in Haiti, it just means that you're from the U.S. or Europe, whether you're white, black, or Asian. You'll generally be called a Blanc. And there is an idea that if you're not Haitian and you come from the first world, that you have more education and more resources than somebody who's Haitian who has a higher level of training. And that goes back to all these, you know, Haiti's history of imperialism and legacies of the way that the country's been treated internationally for 200 years since its successful revolution. Just to remind your listeners that Haiti is the only country in the world that was founded on a successful slave revolution. There have been many slave revolts throughout history, but there was only one that succeeded, and that was the Haitian Revolution of 1791 to 1804, I believe it was, when they finally drove the French out of the island. And because of that revolution, it was only the third republic in modern history after the United States and France, and it was the first black republic in modern history. And the United States especially, which was still a slave-owning society, decided they had to isolate and undermine Haiti because they didn't want the example of free, successful slave rebels not very far away from the southern United States. It was considered to be quite a threat. But to get back to your earlier point about the security issues, yeah, that was definitely a huge problem. Not that security was a problem, but that the disaster response concern with security was a problem.
And Roger, just tell us more about your personal experience interacting with Haitians.
The first night I got down there, we arrived in Bon Repos quite late. We took a bus that broke down south of Port-au-Prince, and close relatives and friends came out in a convoy of about six cars and trucks and picked us up. We were hauling about 1,000 pounds of supplies as well, so they picked us up and drove us through Port-au-Prince and into Bon Repos. We got there just after dark, and I thought it was important to go contact the first team, who were not that far away from where we were staying. They were about maybe 2.5 kilometers. I contacted them through text messaging because regular voice cell phones weren't working very well, and one of Claude's relatives offered to drive me over to the orphanage where the first team was, and the first team texted back, "Oh no, don't travel after dark, it's not safe." And Claude's cousin, Kiko, said, "It's not a problem for me to travel after dark." So he drove me over to the orphanage, and on the way, there's no one on the street, but we came to a place where there were cinder blocks that had been arranged in the street in such a way that you have to almost stop the car and then drive in a zigzag pattern. And Kinko said, "Oh yeah, people do this after dark. They put these barricades in the road to slow you down." And then when we got to the turnoff for the orphanage, there was a barricade that was completely blocking the side road. I said, "Oh, should I get out?" And it was a barricade made of bricks and cinder blocks and tires. And I asked if I should get out and move the tires so we could drive up the street. And Kinko said, "No, I better go out and do that." And as soon as he moved the tires, these four men came out and they got into an argument. And then Kinko got back in the car and we drove through the barricade. And he said, "Well, they put that barricade up because everyone's sleeping in the street. So they said, we can drive through, but please don't come back this way." And I said, "I know a back way, so I won't drive out." And so when we drove up the street, this was about 9:30 at night, we barely could fit through because everyone was sleeping outside. Everyone was afraid to spend too much time indoors. This is, aftershocks were still occurring at this time. So no one wanted to sleep inside their houses. The only place left to sleep was in the street. If you walk down a typical street in Haiti, there's not much in the way of a sidewalk, and there are no vacant lots. There's walls everywhere. Everything is walls where there's not buildings. I remember hearing before I went down about these barricades that had been erected, and they were talking about the barricades as if they were bandit barricades, forcing you to slow down your car so that you could be accosted, or come into a barricade so you can't go any further down the street, so you have to stop, and then you can be robbed. That's not why people were building barricades. They were building barricades to stop cars from running over their children who were sleeping in the street, or to slow cars down so that they wouldn't be driving down the street at 30, 50 miles an hour and throwing dust up everywhere, dust that was settling all over the people who were sleeping in the street because they had nowhere else to go. That's just one example of how it was presented in the media as being lawlessness and people trying to take advantage of the situation, when it actually was just neighborhoods self-organizing in the absence of any public safety to protect their families who were just trying to sleep. The last day that I was there, I had a friend from Washington, D.C., a nurse named Scott Weinstein, and we were just going to walk through downtown Port-au-Prince and check in with different medical facilities. We'd been doing that all along, looking for places where we could be useful, but Scott had met some doctors and nurses on his flight down who were working at the General Hospital, which is the main hospital in Port-au-Prince. So we went there, but first we walked all over downtown Port-au-Prince. We spent about 4.5 hours. We walked through the hardest hit areas of the earthquake. This was on a Sunday, so it's a big market day, so people were out still selling things. You know, that's how a lot of people in Haiti make their income, is they just sell things on the street. So even though the middle of the city was flattened, life was still very much going on. Very, very busy streets, lots of people out, but we saw one other Blanc who was out with, I believe it was his Haitian girlfriend, he was an older man. But other than that, we were the only two Blancs who were walking around for 4.5 hours in downtown Port-au-Prince, which was teeming with people. And the only thing that ever seemed remotely like it could be like a dicey situation is twice we were walking through this one very congested area with a lot of people out on the street, and twice people tried to sell us drugs, thinking that we were, oh, Blancs looking for drugs, which happens in Hartford, Connecticut to me all the time. It's not like Port-au-Prince is this dangerous place where everyone's going to get assaulted. People were surprised to see us walking on the streets, but they were very friendly, and we talked to many people, and we even got free food from one of them. We tried to pay for it, and they gave us free food from their market stall because they said it wasn't worth their while to figure out how much it would cost. We get back to the hospital, and Scott had a meeting with the director of the hospital, and he got a job there. He's still working there now. The general hospital, the hospital buildings were destroyed or compromised, so they reset the hospital up in the courtyard in the interior. So this is a walled courtyard with all of these tents set up, and the hospital is mainly being staffed by Americans, Norwegians, and other internationals. And it's surrounded by soldiers of the 82nd Airborne, who are tightly controlling who can come in and who can go out. And they have their M4 carbines, and they have their machine guns set up. And there's a long line of Haitian folks outside waiting to get in. And Scott and I were standing outside of the director's office after he met with them, and we turned around, and there were four soldiers there with their M4s. And we hadn't seen any other armed soldiers inside the compound yet. And then we saw behind them was a tray with a dolly with food in it. It was mealtime. So someone was pushing this cart around to distribute meals to the patients. So Scott said to one of the soldiers, are you guys guarding the food? And the soldier said, yes, before there were some snatch and grabs, but now everyone knows the Americans are guarding the food, and that doesn't happen anymore. And it was just so ridiculous to think that you're inside a walled compound, a walled courtyard. This is food that is going to patients, but many of whom have, the reason they're there is because they've had operations. So they're amputees, or they're lying in bed, you know, they're screaming going on in some cases because there's not enough pain medication. Surgeries are sometimes being performed with local anesthetic, or in some cases, no anesthetic at all. The idea that one of these patients would somehow hobble up, steal the food, and then run to a corner of the compound, which is completely surrounded by a wall with paratroopers and machine guns on top of it. And number one, that would be a problem. If they're inside the compound, then they're a patient or they're a family member taking care of a patient. They need the food. And number two, the idea that that would even happen without them being stopped by someone else is just ludicrous. But it's symptomatic of this whole narrative that we heard that, well, food can't be distributed because it will cause a riot. Or we can't do this without sufficient security because if we provide help, then, you know, just the strongest people are going to get to it. So the only way we can do it is if we have a platoon of soldiers with machine guns. The fact that this happened inside the heavily guarded hospital compound and that everyone there was very security conscious, after Scott and I had just spent 4.5 hours walking through the hardest hit areas of the city and been given free food by survivors of the earthquake, is just ludicrous. And that just shows how the security concerns were not necessary. There is this idea that is presented in the media that Haiti is a very dangerous place. In some cases, that's true, but the United States is much more dangerous. And oftentimes, even in dangerous places in the United States, the violence doesn't happen to strangers. The violence happens to people who happen to be involved in turf struggles or crime within that area. And that's what someone said to me. They said, well, Haitians often are the victims of street violence, but foreigners practically never are. Haiti actually is a less violent place than many other places, including the Dominican Republic right next door. The Dominican Republic has a higher rate of violent crime than Haiti does, and that was before the earthquake. After the earthquake, from all the indications, and I think I actually heard a quote from one of the U.S. generals there, the violence in Port-au-Prince was less than it was before the quake. And that's what always happens in disasters, is after the disaster, people help each other, and the level of overall everyday violence goes down. What's interesting is every time that a disaster happens, that seems to follow right across the board. But there's this pre-made media narrative that clicks into place, and we saw it in New Orleans after Katrina, and we saw it in Port-au-Prince after this earthquake, that when people of color are involved, the media narrative is, oh, there's roving gangs of violent looters. They're raping and stealing. They're taking advantage and killing people. And it usually turns out that, no, what's actually the case is that people are helping each other and organizing in their communities. But what this myth does is it delays life-saving supplies and treatment while security measures are taken up.
We'll hear more from Roger Benham next time, a volunteer with Mutual Aid Disaster Relief Haiti, mutualaiddisasterrelief.org. The group has sent 4 medical teams thus far to work in some of the hardest hit areas around Port-au-Prince after the January earthquake that took an unknown number of lives. Next time, Roger Benham gives us a closer look at the life-saving efforts of Mutual Aid, shares what he learned about Haiti's history, and helps us understand the meaning of his favorite new term in Creole, Kembe Femme.
Probably my favorite saying, well, practically anywhere, and that's in Creole, Kembe Femme. The nearest translation of that into English is stay strong.
Talk Nation Radio is produced in Storrs, Connecticut. I'm Dory Smith. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. This program is syndicated with Pacifica Network. Our music is by Fritz Heed. And you can contact us at talknationradio@gmail.com.
Oh, 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 concrete castle king.